Welcome to episode 4 of Decoded, a podcast by Marriott Digital Services, bringing together the smartest minds, the best digital leaders in the digital space, and all part of a 10-part series on all things digital marketing. I'm Chris, the Director of Customer Success for Marriott Digital Services, and I'm joined by Mike, Director of Program Management for MDS. Hi, Mike. How are you?
Good, Chris. How are you?
I'm good. So this week, we're chatting the usual news. We've got a bunch to get through, and we're also joined by a couple of guests throughout the show today. So we're going to be joined by Laura from our paid media team to talk about a new Expedia feature that's just launched. We're also speaking to Manuel from the Marriott Digital Services team based in Sydney in Australia. He's a really great mind, and we talk about the Asia market, the impact of the pandemic on his marketing strategy, alongside talking about some best practices and also some things that have been happening in his region. So to the news, the first one is about WhiteSpark. So WhiteSpark are a company based in Canada. They build tools and provide services that help businesses and agencies with various different local search marketing aspects. They really do live and breathe the local search aspects and really known far and wide for writing and also speaking about it. And back in December, they wrote a blog on the 2020 local search ranking factors. And they surveyed about 50 local search experts about things that were happening in local search rankings and organic signals, how to rank in the local four pack. And they had some pretty interesting results, Mike, alongside, you know, various different growth and importance of Google My Business and the decline in other citations, along with a slight dip in the importance of inbound links.
Yeah, Chris, thanks for pulling this piece up. Local surveys and local ranking factor reviews have been around for probably a decade or so. They've been published with different sources over the years. It was with SEO Moz for a number of years when they were in the local search game. And then once they exited it, it switched over to WhiteSpark. This is an interesting survey because they don't do it every year. Every couple of years, it kind of pops up. And it's always a really good guiding light for SEOs for what you need to focus on when you're doing local. So I'll call out the big factors right now here with the percentages, and I'll kind of break down what I think it means to us. So this survey more or less interviewed tons of great minds in the SEO space on what drives the needle for local. And we'll include the names to the people that I find the most entertaining and informative on Twitter in the show notes. I won't bore you with the names here. But the top line of it is it's in terms of impact to local search, it's 33% Google My Business, followed by 16% reviews, 15% on page, 13% links, 8% behavioral, 7% citations, and 6% personalization. So you add that all together, that should largely be a composite and proxy for what are the most important aspects to look at for how to optimize for local search. And I think it's important to note that this is all about local finder and four pack visibility. This isn't about driving visibility or higher rankings in your classic blue links, which are slowly evaporating from Google, but it's all about getting that four pack placement in a higher place. So since this isn't done every couple of years, it's kind of fun to always look at like what's the difference, what's the change. And I'll tell you, if you look at the combination of Google My Business optimization, which is taking that platform as far as it can go and building out all the fields and being accurate with it, you combine that together with reviews and on-page factor, you've got 64% of the overall optimization pack really lands there. So you really can't ignore GMB reviews or on-page local. And that's on-page local is making sure your address is there. It's probably coded in schema. Your reviews are that there's reviews on your site. There's all the information and all that that great information around location, maybe even adding in some geo coordinates and some lat long. That's all what would be classified in on-page. And to me, what's the most striking here is years ago, we were kind of obsessed as an industry with Facebook fans, Twitter followers, and how many of those helped influence local. And it's not even on the chart at this point in time. I think it really signals to you that those types of social factors, maybe if they once did, mean something they don't now. And also the decline of citations are probably the most interesting to me. So if you recall, there was years ago in our very old world, you and I used to have conversations about submitting to Localese and local.com and all those ones that we made a big deal about years ago. And now seemingly the importance of them has really dropped with the emergence of Google My Business. And again, if you add it all up together, that's the prize right there.
And also recently Skift announced the results for their travel survey, and each month they do a pulse check of the travel industry on basically the sentiment of travel and the percentage of the population that's traveled throughout that month. And they do this really to keep a sense of what's happening in the market. In December, it showed that 28% of the US population traveled, and that was down from 37% in October. But critically, though, it was 10% above October, so it's going in the right direction. That's not surprising, though. I think in October, I was personally trying to book travel, booking hotel stays, looking at places to go further afield than maybe the state of Maryland or Virginia. Then it gets to the middle of December, and you start to feel a little bit uneasy about that and cancel. So I can understand why, you know, the mindset shift has changed. Looking at the data, it seems that family visits continue to be the biggest driver of travel, just over half of that percentage people saying that they traveled for family reasons. And cancellation and postponement remains high at just over 52% of people saying they had to either cancel or postpone. So some good data there for December, Mike.
I would agree. It personally, for me, it kind of matches the way that I've seen my parents. So they're in Arizona. They were here in either September or October. They were supposed to be here in December and January, and we had to cancel the trips, unfortunately. So I think everything's seemingly back on for the spring if everything trends in the right direction. But I can tell you, it's my personal life matches to that, as well as whenever we've traveled, we've tried to do trips within 3-hour windows. So it's been a VRBO here or a house rental there, and it's largely kind of jumped into those windows that I think are emerging pretty well. They're in the data now.
Yeah, I mean, the whole study was based on a sample size of just over 1,000 people. So it's not, they've not surveyed the whole population of 300 million people in America to determine how many people travel, but it's a good indication of data size. I think, you know, year over year analysis is kind of a bit wonky with this now. I think also talking about this Expedia feature that we'll talk about in a little bit with Laura, that this is prime for why they've probably launched that. So we'll jump into that in a moment.
So a question for you, Chris. So I think we've all seen changes in technology and tools that the pandemic's brought out to us. You know, there's more takeout, there's more pre-ordering, there's more online subscriptions, all those types of things. Is there anything from here that you think will still be around in about a year? Let's say things get back to normal, but anything strike you as a tool that's emerged that you'd like to see stay around?
I think personally for me, I don't think I've adopted a new tool because of being at home more or anything like that. But what it has made me do is invest in better Wi-Fi, invest in more subscription services like Netflix, Prime, Disney Plus, like YouTube TV, like all of the, maybe we might've had one of those and slightly slower Wi-Fi because we weren't at home all the time. And then all of a sudden you then supercharge your Wi-Fi, you get every subscription thing known to man. And I think they're not going anywhere because you then create a level of standard of living in your house, right? If you go from 200 megabit Wi-Fi to 1,000 megabit Wi-Fi, you're not wanting to go back, I don't think. So how about yourself?
Probably pre-ordering food for pickup. So I have two young kids, so going to restaurants is kind of a disaster to begin with. So the fact that there's more reliable time slot confirmation and I can prepay makes getting food for kids a lot easier. So I would say that. And then just a reminder to myself to go to your house when I need that good thick Wi-Fi.
Yeah, well, I think the other thing is, like, we went to a local winery yesterday, and the ability to book what you want and book the space that you want within the environment there is something that if you'd have a year ago, you wouldn't have been able to do that. It would have been on first come, first serve. You'd have had to get there for midday, bang on, to get the table that you wanted. So there's definitely been some good enhancements, and I hope they, you know, once everything calms down, they do stick with those types of features when you're booking, you know, wineries or breweries or something like that.
Those are positives for sure.
Absolutely. So Google announced that they may well be leaving Australia, which was something that was announced post sitting down with Manuel, which we'll hear later in today's podcast. But Google announced that they may have to remove the search functionality in Australia. So what's going on, Mike?
This is an interesting one. So for years, Google has had issues with largely European countries related to IP, privacy, right to be forgotten, et cetera. And this appears to be one of the newest ones that's popped up. So what the Australian government, and I don't claim to know much about Australia, they seemingly want Google to pay the publishers in which they link to. So I know that's a mouthful to hear, but more or less Google links out to websites that then hold the information, right? Sometimes they basically take that information and ingest it into their system and expose it out in what they call rich snippets. So if you're in Google and you see an IMDb poll of Oscar winners, right? And it says like from IMDb and it's gray or the box looks different, that's a rich snippet. It's an easy way to pull that information from another website and put it in Google. And 9 times out of 10, they give the credit to that site. But it's been a sticking point for years. And this seems to be one of those instances where the country of Australia seemingly is taking the stance of Google is stealing traffic or visitors or something of value from these publishers, and to be included in there, it's really Google's problem to solve, and that they need to pay out to those sites that they're linking to share in the profit, right? Google fundamentally is a free market company. They make the majority of their revenue on advertising and then services under that. So I think this is one of those things where, you know, I'm sure they'll work it out. I'm sure there'll be some deal. There's a little bit of a precedent in France where there is this seemingly very legalistic phrase around the right to negotiate agreements and licensing. So I'm sure some of that's going to emerge here, but it's great timing. And you know, maybe we could have Manuel come in and do a part two with us at one point if Google disappears, but I really do hope that's not the case.
Yes, I read online that in Australia, was it 19 million searches a day performed on Google? So if you think about the Google ecosystem overall, it's not a huge percentage of that. Of a population of just over 20 million people, I guess a large proportion of people are using that service already. So it would make a big impact in that market if they were to do that.
Right. I think Google's at like 90% market share, but to your point, it's a smaller population. So hopefully it stays around.
So more on Google, actually. So back in November, Google launched a new report outlining stats and ultimately crawling history of your site. So when they've crawled your site to get more information. And some people have recently noticed a bump in the stats, leading to a theory that Google was crawling the site more to improve the customer experience on their own site and influence search rankings. And in January, just a couple of days ago, Google announced that the crawl stat report has increased its reporting coverage for additional types of crawls versus just, you know, doing it more to improve the customer experience. So as a result, they've announced that you may see a jump in the number of crawls reported for your site, but it does not reflect additional crawling for your site to improve search rankings. It's just a reporting improvement. So what do you take of that, Mike?
I don't really care for it. So I would take any data Google gives you on crawling, search keywords, any of that visibility stuff with a grain of salt, right? So this is the same company that for decades said they would never remove the number of times a keyword appeared in your search traffic logs. They did it. They have a long history of underreporting and overreporting data and crawl data. I personally consider it like directional at best, of like we're getting crawled or we're not getting crawled. I wouldn't put a lot of actual stock in it. If you are really serious about this, there's tons of tools out there that can actually do proper log file analysis, which is looking at when a robot comes to your website, when they ping it, hits the server, and then what it's identified as. There's tools out there like called Botify or BrightEdge that we use. It's a new tool called Log File Analyzer that allows you to look at when you've actually been crawled by Googlebot, Applebot, Wazebot, you know, Baidubot, whatever it is. So I'd say, I think the story sounds really compelling and it sounds like there's a problem, but this is just, you know, a pebble in the lake for them.
The Consumer Electronics Show, or CES, as many people know it, took place virtually this year. Normally it's held in Las Vegas, and there were some pretty cool things previewed at the show. So Mike and I pulled out our favorite travel gadget and also just our favorite overall gadget. So we'll start with the travel gadget. Mike, what did you like from the show that you saw?
So this one is heady. I think CES is, to me, it's in Canada, it's a little bit boring because it's mostly like TVs and weird stuff. It's not like Apple or here's the next version of Windows. It ends up with these weird spaces besides like OLED TVs, and if you remember, there was like the bent TVs for a while, or the what word am I looking for, Chris?
The curved TV.
Curve, yeah, that's it.
I had one of those, man.
Did you?
I did. Yeah, they're good.
Where is it now?
It's in my old rental. but it, seriously, I when I saw it, I was like, I don't know, they look a bit weird. But it did change the viewing experience of watching TV. You never got a glare on it from the windows.
Good stuff. So what the one that the travel gadget that jumped out to me most is, it's not so much a gadget as it seems to be a technology. And I didn't realize this until doing the research, but apparently cobalt, which is in batteries, is an incredibly toxic and awful material that you basically have to mine it, and it seems like the Republic of Congo is where you get the majority of it. And it's all if you Google it, it's a whole bunch of bad business. But apparently there is now a push to get either low or no cobalt batteries built. So it basically removes this one piece of the mix that makes up a battery, of which I know nothing about, but it sounds like if you can remove cobalt from batteries, you seemingly stop a human rights violation set. So I'd say no more cobalt in batteries.
Yeah, I saw, I was looking through kind of the, you know, the top 20 travel gadgets and things like that, and there was one called Pocket Talk, which was a translator device, but it allows you to have this two-way translation of voice notes, so you're able to talk into it in English and it will translate that back in 82 different languages. So you could select Chinese and it would talk back pretty well. I think it looked great. The price point was pretty good. I think when international travel is a thing, you could totally see people using those. They're fair, you know, after looking at the product, there's other products like that, but they may do less languages or they may be slightly more expensive. And this seemed to be like the one that does the most languages at the best price point ultimately.
So how does it work? Do you pull it out and you talk into it and then it speaks back to the other person?
Yeah. So it's like the 1990s dictaphone. So you basically you select the language that you want to speak in and what you want it to output at. You speak into it, you say whatever you need to say, and then it will repeat that back in that language to whomever you're speaking to.
We should try a podcast like that one of these years.
Yeah, I mean, it might be fun, like in trying to do this in Chinese. But so how about just in general, Mike, kind of the general kind of gadgets or technology, what did you find?
Sure. So if I stick with the kind of outrageous things, there's something called the LG Rollable, which is it's a smartphone that you might think would roll in a way, or the screen would roll up, but it's not. It's actually an expanding screen. So it appears to be that if you almost think about the way that like a TV projector screen kind of like rolls up and down, that's what the LG Rollable seems to do. Is basically, if you want a big phone, you click some buttons, it becomes a big phone. If you want a small one, the screen shrinks. So I don't know how this thing's going to do. I don't know if it's got a shot. Folding phones seem to be esoteric at best, so we'll see. But I like seeing all of this weird phone tech, because it makes me a little bit excited about phone stuff again, because right now it's pretty boring. You know, it's like you get what, 16 cameras in your phone now. This is something to get excited about.
Yeah it looked pretty cool, like, and I do like the, I think Samsung did it, like the folding phone that was like the folding screen. I could see totally how they're used, because there are times where you're like, oh, I'm on my phone, I'm just searching something, it's easy, or I want to watch a video. And then it's kind of small on your phone, so you may want to expand it where you've got it there versus switching to another device. So I could see like the customer interaction with it, but yeah, let's see whether it comes to life. The one that I saw was the Frame TV, and it's something that I personally love. I can't afford one, but it's a wall-mounted TV that ultimately looks good. So back to my old rental days where that curved TV had cables like running down the side of it, and it looked kind of obtuse above the fireplace. This product isn't kind of new, but they've made it thinner and now looking even better. So it truly looks like a painting that's hung on the wall. So if you've got your Google Chromecast with your pictures coming through, it looks truly like a picture. And then you can switch very easily over to the TV. So I thought that was kind of cool to make them making it even smaller and even thinner and making it look even better.
Sure, it'll be a wonderful addition to your next rental.
Absolutely. So the last bit of news is that Expedia recently announced a new feature to their paid advertising platform, Expedia Travel Ads. And we're going to now be joined by Laura from our paid media team to explain more about what's going on. So Laura, how are you?
I'm doing well. And thank you for having me as a guest on the podcast.
Cool. So before we get started and get into it, it's been around for years, but for those who don't know, what is Expedia Travel Ads?
Yeah, so Expedia Travel Ads is an advertising platform that we've been leveraging for a while now, and it allows hotels to bid on premium placements within the destination search pages across both Expedia and Expedia International points of sale. So that's the key value add and why we leverage Expedia Travel Ads in our marketing strategy.
And they recently launched a new feature targeting distance from the user's home. So what's the lowdown?
Yeah, so this is something we're really excited about. Just for some background, you know, we saw regional and domestic travel opening up, and obviously international travel remains closed or quite limited. So collectively, we knew we needed to shift our hotel's audience targeting to a more local domestic market. And so in order to do that, in response, Expedia had launched the Travel Shopper within 100 miles targeting tool, which ultimately allows hotel advertisers to target travelers looking to book locally. So this tool, which is just embedded into our existing Travel Ads platform, allows us to capture domestic travel, target travelers looking to stay at local drive-to locations, and most importantly, get a competitive advantage in the local market to help aid our recovery efforts.
Sounds awesome. Thanks for the intel, Laura. So I am not an Expedia user. I have not used the tool in for quite a long time. Maybe just check a flight or so here or there. But is there anything in there related to like personalization or demographic targeting? Because it sounds like they're taking the leap with location and expanding it and trying to get that 3-hour window, which we know is pretty popular. Anything else new in the Hopper form?
I wouldn't say anything brand new. However, they have slowly over time rolled out a series of advanced targeting tools, and that stems from, you know, mobile targeting to, you know, length of stay targeting. So thinking users who are trying to book 3+ days, 6+ days, etc., as well as geographic targeting. So targeting by country, and that's the point of sale piece where, especially during, you know, the climate right now, it may not make sense to be pushing ads out to locations that can't actually book in said country. So throughout these various targeting tools, we're able to really hone in on the right, you know, the right market at the right time, depending on, you know, where we're seeing demand come from.
I mean, it's really clever. I mean, if you look at that, what we were discussing earlier, Mike, about the Skift travel trends, with the largest majority of travel that took place in December, people traveling within 100 miles by car. This is like bang on targeting that environment, right? So they've been pretty clever in how they've activated this, I think. All right, well, thank you so much for joining us, Laura. As always, we're gonna link all of the articles and more information on these topics in the show notes. So if you want to hear more about the topics, then head over there, check them out, and we'll make sure that we link to this one about Expedia Travel Ads too. So thanks again, Laura.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, we're going to take a real short break and we'll come back with an interview with our colleague Manuel. He's based in our Sydney office and we're going to talk all about Asian travel trends and some of the things that he's been doing in his market to really drive business in the last 12 months. We now want to spend some time talking about an in-depth topic, and we do this every time that we release a podcast. So let's move on to the educational topic for today. And this week we're going truly global, and we're speaking to Manuel all the way from Sydney, Australia. So Manuel, how are you today?
Good day from a really hot day in Sydney today. I'm good, and you?
All good, all good. So you're obviously with the Marriott Digital Services team, so can you tell us a little bit about your role and what you do within the team?
Sure. So I'm the director of digital consulting for Australia, New Zealand and Pacific Islands. And together with my team, we're basically in charge of the digital strategy for our 36 hotels in Australia, New Zealand, Fiji, Samoa and New Caledonia, which is very exciting.
So interestingly, Manuel and I used to work together. It must have been maybe 2013, 14 in London. And Manuel's at the Heathrow Windsor Marriott, which used to be the Slough Windsor Marriott. So Manuel, how did you come to be in Australia, which is far better than being in London?
I have great memories from London and also from working with you. But, you know, being Italian, adapting to the weather in London is very challenging. And it was very challenging for me. I also met my partner in London. He's not Australian, he's actually Polish, but we both had a passion for Australia. And so we decided to basically jump down under and move to Sydney. And it worked out. And we've been here for 6 years now.
Fantastic. So if I was to ask you, you know, clearly you're involved a lot in digital marketing and you're working with hotels, you know, in some fantastic locations like Fiji and Sydney and Melbourne, but what do you like the most about digital marketing?
Mainly that we can provide solutions to business pains in a very efficient and cost-effective way. Digital always has a plan A, and if plan A doesn't work, then we have plan B or C. And that's the beautiful thing of digital marketing. For what concerns my true passion is really web development. And lately, for the past 2 years, I've been improving my knowledge of a web development platform that is called Webflow, which I really love to use, especially for creating small websites and so on.
And you're, of course, based in the Asia market and in the hub of Sydney. And we actually have teams across all of Asia. But I was wondering if maybe, could you give maybe three differences in the digital space across Asia that maybe is different to maybe businesses or hotels located in Europe or the Americas?
Yeah, sure. Well, in Asia, obviously, there are some players that are very different from Europe and the US, especially when it comes to search engines. And my first thought, for example, goes to Korea Naver, which is a local search engine in Korea. The other point is that there is a lot of video streaming, which is very popular in the Asia market. Platforms like TikTok, but also live streams across Facebook to sell offers and packages are very, very popular. For the Australia, New Zealand and Pacific Island market specifically, Australia is usually the test bed for new technologies and new solutions in the digital landscape. And we also have very big players such as Atlassian and Canva. Canva specifically is a great tool for small businesses to create digital marketing assets in a few clicks. Some of our hotels are also taking advantage of this, especially if they have limited marketing resources on property. For Fiji, which is very interesting actually, TikTok and Viber are really big players in that small island country. Specifically, Viber now offers advertising solutions. So now that there is no international travel, it's really key to explore these solutions to capture the domestic demand.
So am I right in thinking in Korea, Naver is bigger than Google in the Korea market? Is that accurate?
I actually checked the stats this morning in terms of market share. So Google still seems to have a higher market share than Naver. But when it comes to the local experience, obviously, and when you are a local in Korea, you would definitely use Naver to perform your search because it's very local. In Japan as well, for example, Yahoo is one of the biggest player in Japan when it comes to search engines. For what concerns our market, like Australia, New Zealand, and Pacific, the bigger player, but in their own local nuances, like google.com.au, google.co.nz, and so on.
Can you just talk a little bit about Viber? That's not something that I've personally heard about before. Like what sort of platform is it? What type of things can customers do on there?
Yeah, sure. So Viber is a communication app. So it's like a chat, like WhatsApp. It has end-to-end encryption. And it also has some advertising solutions that they recently launched. We're now trying to get into a trial with Viber to test these advertising solutions specifically in Fiji. But it seems to be quite a new player in our market. And at the same time, any new player is worth exploring, especially when the bigger players usually they work more on an international landscape. But again, without international travel, we need to think more on a domestic landscape and how do we actually target capture the local demand and the local customer. So it's really about looking at those local solutions and also customizing the marketing message to the local market.
So it's pretty clear that there are some major differences compared to where Chris and I have hung our hats from. Before we get too far and stray from it, I do want to go back to live streaming for a second. So you mentioned it's really prominent. You mentioned the platforms it's on, and that also it's something where you're talking about deals and so forth. That's really different than how I think Chris and I normally see live streaming when we open up our phones. Could you talk a little bit about how that evolved and grew in your area?
Sure. So live streaming has become really popular, especially in Thailand, for example. Our colleagues in the TVCM team, they've tested live streaming a few times, and it's proven to be quite successful, especially to advertised hotel deals in our specific case. And live streaming is so popular because it's also engaging. Usually there will be very entertaining personalities running the live streaming, which obviously is a key part in keeping users onto their screens, onto their phone screens. But at the same time, you also get kind of a personal connection with whoever is running the live stream. If you think about it, when you see, when you're targeted by an ad, like a static image ad on Facebook, it's quite different from actually participating to a live stream and see someone live that tells you, we have this amazing offer, this amazing product, you should totally try it out. Again, it's all about the personal connection. And I think the live stream really ticked that box.
That's such a unique approach to it. So if we were to play a little bit of theater of the mind, like how would someone promote like a deal or an offer there? Because it's pretty clear that the personalities come across quickly, but what would you do with that? Would you talk about like, here's where we should go and this is the deal and then go to this place to find out more? Like how do you connect that call to action to booking?
Yeah, so basically, for example, some live streams, they happen live in our case from the hotels. So you can clearly see a live view of what the product is, which I think is very important. And it's quite different from seeing, very a picture that has gone through post-production and has a lot of changes. So you can really see what the real product is. Also, in terms of call to action, what do you do after you are targeted by this live stream? You can definitely share a promo code. You can mention the hotel name and the contact number or the hotel website, and users will be able to go on the site and actually perform a booking. Again, for what concerns our industry, of course. So I think that that's really what is powerful about the live streaming is the personal connection, but also the clear instruction on how to book an offer, which sometimes you cannot really deliver, for example, on ads on Facebook due to the character limit in the ads and the fact that Facebook only displays three lines of text of your ad. So it's really quite powerful.
Talk about new approaches to put heads in beds, right? That's fantastic.
Yeah.
So let me jump back a little bit. You were talking again about the different platforms and strategies and so forth there, and how you can look at a market worth like Korea, where Google's still ahead of Naver, even though it seems like at least there's a lot of thought leadership around how Naver has taken up a lot of market share. Can you tell me a little or tell us a little bit about how the experiences are different for a user? Like if you were to use Naver versus Google like side by side on your computer, Why would someone be drawn to Naver versus Google?
I think it's also it's mainly the way the two solutions are built. Google, you get the same experience regardless of the market because the page looks exactly the same, it's clean. You get obviously the same search experience is exactly the same. Neighbor is slightly different and is, I think it has more, from a design perspective, it has more of a, it responds more to the local needs of that market in terms of, you know, displaying obviously the local language. Also the way it reads is much different. And I'm saying this with no knowledge whatsoever of the Korean language, but obviously it's a product that is built in the country and it's very localized. So I think when it comes to digital marketing in general, it's really important to take into account the target audience and the target market. And every website should be customized to the target market, whether it is in terms of content or design, depending on, you know, even looking at factors like internet speed and device availability, the type of device that is used in devices that are used in the country. I think these are all factors that we need to take into account whenever we look at the digital experience in a specific market.
I think digital experience is something that's changed so much since we've gone into the pandemic and had to really live with COVID for almost a year now. You talk so much about how the platforms have evolved and just interesting approaches to using them. Is there one particular platform or a specific strategy you've seen a player take that has really impressed you as a marketer?
Well, during the pandemic, obviously hit our industry pretty hard, for our market specifically here in Australia, the situation was even quite worse, I would say, because all the states and territory they had to close the domestic borders, so we didn't even have domestic travel happening for an extended period of time. Industries have had to be quite creative in generating revenue. And for example, one thing that was pretty common across the hospitality industry here in Australia was selling gift cards and hampers. Hampers specifically, hampers meaning, for example, we provide you with our restaurant experience, but in a form of a box or a hamper that you can just pre-order, come and pick it up at the hotel, and you can enjoy either outdoors or in the comfort of your home. And that actually helped keeping a lot of local businesses and even smaller players in the hospitality industry afloat. So I'd say that is really a creative way of generating revenue and still providing some sort of hospitality experience to guests.
I would agree. I'm blown away sometimes by how good an experience can be of getting curbside or takeout. I just went to a local place here, Kava, that haven't been to in a while. And I ordered everything online and I went there and it felt as warm as inviting to do a pickup and leave as it did to actually dine there. So it's so cool to see that those things are still connecting the dots across the globe.
So Manuel, I heard that some of your hotels in your markets did some pretty cool things, like bringing certain destinations to Australia, like bringing Bali to Australia. So can you talk through kind of what happened and how you activated that?
Sure. So for those of you who may not know that, Bali is considered like a second home to Aussies. I think that Australians are definitely the first source markets to Bali in terms of you know, the hospitality industry and the travel industry in general. But obviously with the pandemic, Aussies could not fly to Bali. I also love Bali myself. I've been there 3 times. It's one of my most favorite places. So one of our hotels, W Brisbane, partnered with W Bali Seminyak, and basically brought the Balinese experience down under. So they've they've tweaked the outdoor pool area to resemble really a pool, but in Bali. So with Balinese umbrellas, coconuts, all the decor that is traditional of Bali. And it was pretty successful, not just from a, from a performance perspective, but also from a media coverage perspective. So it really put the hotel under the magnifying glass during that moment. And it was just, I couldn't travel to Brisbane at the time, so I was really jealous of all the guests that were enjoying that, and I couldn't, but it was really a great experience.
So looking specifically at your market now in Australia, and you've mentioned this a couple of times, it being obviously very domestic with borders being closed, but I don't know if you could talk a little bit about how, you know, what the early 2021 signs are and how users are maybe researching and booking a little bit differently.
Yeah, look, when we look at the search patterns, one driving factor in terms of deciding where to stay or where to go is definitely safety and cleanliness right now. Australia, similar to New Zealand, had an elimination strategy when it comes to COVID. We had zero cases in the past few days, which is pretty good. Obviously cleanliness and safety, as I said, is really important. So I think translating that into marketing platforms or marketing messages online and really outlining what is the cleanliness strategy for any hospitality venue, whether it is a hotel, a restaurant, or even an events venue, is really crucial. And I think it's still going to be definitely a driving factor in terms of where do I go and where do I stay for 2021. For the travel landscape specifically, it still seems to be that Australia is mainly going to work off the domestic market for a while. Our flagship airline Qantas opened ticket sales for international flights from July 2021. However, the international borders are technically still closed. So until the federal government opens the borders again, we won't be able to enjoy these flights. But we really hope with the rollout of the vaccine, especially in Australia, which is starting next month, that the situation is going to change very soon. So we're very optimistic about that.
So looking to the future, you know, the international borders in the Asian countries are back open, the world is back traveling again. And, you know, think of me as a marketing manager at a hotel in New York or San Francisco or London. And I want to attract, you know, people coming from Asia or from Australia to my hotel or to my restaurant. You know, maybe what can you list out 2 to 3 things that you would recommend any hotel doing to attract customers from your part of the world?
I think that, you know, everybody, I think, really wants to start traveling internationally again, especially me. But I think when the international markets and borders will reopen, for example, we really need to find passion points to connect with your target market. So for a hotel in New York that wants to target Aussies, for example, going there is definitely about finding that connection and that those common points that Australians, for example, can relate to. At the same time, also providing still some information about safety and cleanliness, because it's, as I said, is still going to be crucial, I think, for the rest of 2021 and probably 2022 as well. The pandemic really left us with a lot to work with, and I think that safety is still going to be the prime factor in deciding where to go and where to stay. So yeah, I'd say really finding passion points and at the same time assuring that wherever you stay in New York, for example, you're going to have a safe stay and you're going to have an enjoyable stay.
Yeah, I think that point of cleanliness and communicating what's, you know, available. I think we've mentioned on this podcast before about sometimes it's very difficult to find that information. I've been looking locally for restaurants when we were able to eat indoors, and you were looking on their website, you were looking on their social pages, you're looking on their GMB pages, and you couldn't see anything. You know, they weren't communicating what they were doing. However, you knew that they were doing something. And that's the important piece, is making sure that you communicate as a business what you're doing, because then customers can understand it and take the decision themselves. Yes, that meets my expectations, or maybe it doesn't meet my expectations and I'll go somewhere else. But making sure that you communicate that is so important. So one last question from us. And I think I maybe know the answer based on what you've just said, but you know, you have the opportunity to travel anywhere in the world. Where are you going?
Well, the first place that I definitely have to go is probably go back home and visit my family in Tuscany, which I've not seen for 2 years. And I usually do that during the Australian winter, which means there is summer in Tuscany, so I can enjoy summer in Tuscany and then come back to Australia. But definitely Bali, as I said, because Bali is just a dream destination to go to. It's really great. We do have great properties over there. And it's always both a relaxing holiday to have, but also very entertaining because there is a lot to do in Bali.
We have a friend of the show. He's a former colleague of Chris and I's. I don't know if you ever worked with Fred Schaub. He's got family in Tuscany and he was just there. So maybe you can say hi when you get there, but it's great to know there's all these Italian connections back within MDS. But Manuel, it was wonderful to speak with you today.
It was wonderful to speak with you guys and thank you very much for the time.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Manuel. And we'll post a link to, the W Bali activation that was done and a few of the other things that you mentioned as well within the show notes. But again, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. We're grateful that you joined this journey with us today. You can get in touch with the show on Twitter at @MDS_decoded or by emailing us at MDS@marriott.com. Feel free to send in any questions that you might have and we'll review them on the show in the up and coming episodes. If you like today's conversation and you can spare a few minutes, it would be fantastic if you could share a review on iTunes. It really does help more and more people find the show and make sure that we're sharing this knowledge with more and more people. The next episode will be released in just 2 weeks, so make sure that you hit subscribe to be notified when that goes live. And you can enjoy this podcast on any good podcasting app, and you can learn more about digital marketing at mdsdecoded.com. Thanks for listening.